So, Whitney, this was your selection. This is Better Get It In Your Soul, a tribute to Charles Mingus and the big band. So what were you thinking about when you chose this one for us?
Contrast to the things that Joe was saying about kind of music pointing you towards your inner life, and kind of maybe we all felt a little drawn inward by that last piece, this piece really kind of draws you outward in a bodily way. I find it really hard to listen to this song without moving my body. And I think the way, part of how it does that is it gives you the melody kind of early on. It gives you the trill of the horns, give you that melody early on, and it kind of sets the terms for what you want. And so you hear the melodic line, and then you're just waiting for it, and then you experience the kind of satisfaction of when it's given to you, and then you experience the kind of the tension of when it's the song teases you in different ways, it's kind of playing with that melody, and so what I think is interesting about that is that to experience the pull of that, to be pulled along by that song, is you're holding on to the note that has kind of passed away. And so it's the thing that's kind of in the past that's part of your experience of the present notes, and that's pushing you towards the anticipation of what's to come. And so that tells us something about experiencing a piece of music, is that we hold on to what's no longer there, and we're anticipating something that's not yet here. But it also tells us something about the structure of our experience, just more generally. Any present moment, and especially kind of the emotional weight of any present moment, is informed by a past and is informed by our anticipation of a future.
Because you have patterns that you're expecting are going to repeat.
Because
if you were truly 100% open-minded, it could be as much a horn blast as somebody
exactly.
banging on a steel drum.
Exactly, yeah. We're not just purely open. It's we've been shaped by the notes mm-hmm. that have been played, and we've been shaped by our past in a particular way that makes the present have the feel that it does for us.
Now, earlier, before you set up the song, you were saying, what is it in us? So
yeah.
what do you really mean by that question? What kind of what in us?
Well, I guess it's not what is it in us, but what are we, such that we can experience a piece of music? And I think the answer is we are temporal beings. And Jeff was saying something about this earlier in his comments. And it's similar to what you were just saying. We're never just purely openly experiencing, but we are kind of carrying forward a past and looking toward a future. And so it's never just a kind of open present moment, but it's a present that is made meaningful by a past and by an anticipated future.
I mean, would that not be true for animals?
Yeah, I think it probably is true of animals. I have a dog, and so she, I think, is certainly driven by anticipation of food,
oh, yeah.
anticipation of pets.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's true. It could be true to, maybe not to as, like their past isn't as rich. I would say my dog's past isn't as rich as my past, and so her present is maybe not as rich as my present.
Now, Whitney, did I overhear you saying that you use music in your courses at LaSalle?
I do, yeah. And this is a song I really like to play to make this point about temporality and about the real significance of the past, but also of the future. You know, if you are planning a trip or you have a certain kind of career in mind for yourself, to have that future, obstructed in some way can really affect your present, right? So we're never just in the present, but we're kind of always going somewhere. We're always coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I may, Whitney, you mentioned at the beginning as you started speaking about how, unlike Joe's selection, you couldn't help but tap your foot, and you really can't help but tap your foot at a minimum when you're listening to that. So one thing is, you know, discussing this sort of conception of ourselves as temporal beings seems in some respects, maybe for some folks, abstract and a little heady. But I wonder to the extent to which, you know, this is we better get this in our soul. You know, this moves us, right? You know, and so there's a part of this that also points to and gestures to ourselves as embodied and not just moved emotionally by music, but moved physically
oh, yeah.
by music in a way that allows us to, in a similar way, bring our bodies as we know them and as we experience them and as we hope for them to express themselves into the music. So our we're not merely disembodied temporal beings. We are, embodied.
Whose emotions can inhabit the body? I mean, it seems like that's what the movement is about. So where, as the first song sort of drew us inward, this draws us outward. But I'm feeling something in those moments. But if you pressed me to sort of distinguish my bodily gestures and movements from what I'm feeling, I would struggle to do so because they both seem so present and together and intermixed and interweaved. And the other thing that I like about this song and sort of others like it is the way that it plays with familiarity and unfamiliarity.
Yeah,
you can sort of tap your toe. You can bob your head. It's predictable in a certain way, but then there are tensions created with the surprises that happen with the improvisation. And so it satisfies both of these things at once, which I think is something about us, that we want sort of a predictability, but we also appreciate surprise. And a song like this can do both of those things at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. That's amazing. That's an amazing thing.
And yet what's interesting is that improvisation is not just absolutely random.
Right.
So, and this has kind of been a conversation of just the last few months, at least in my awareness, about artificial intelligence and the way that these programs can create songs in the style of various people. So they are predicting the improvisational abilities of other folks. So I'm curious as to your question earlier, Whitney, about, the we are temporal beings. Would you assign that same quality to whatever artificial intelligence is out, able to, look at information and take it somewhere?
Oh, I don't know.
those are philosophers. You're supposed to be.
We've actually been talking about this this weekend. We've been talking about music generated by AI and mostly puzzling. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if we've. What we've drawn out of those, but we've been kind of dealing with that in the last couple of days a little bit.
I mean, I guess one thing I might say about that is just this idea about our temporality that we've been talking about. It's not just that we're temporal, but it's our temporality that gives our experience meaning, to us. Like, experience is meaningful for us. So and to say the song is emotional is to say kind of how it's meaningful, and it's hard. I don't know if it makes sense to me to say that something is meaningful to a machine that's producing.
Yeah,
so that's a very useful distinction.
I actually heard some artificial intelligence generated improvisational jazz a couple of years ago. So probably the technology is more sophisticated now, but it was a mess. It was some virtuosic soloing mixed in with drumming and so on, and then it just would never end. It didn't begin, it didn't end, it just kind of just moved along and then stopped. And I don't know if a person who didn't know it was AI would identify it as AI. Maybe they'd think, oh, this is an interesting experimental piece of music. But knowing that it was AI, it sounded to me like a being that's not temporal produced this.
Okay. It's like that scene in The Fifth Element. I don't know if you remember the movie with Bruce Willis. There's a singer that has kind of a wild set of notes.
Yes, the opera. Towards the end. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, something that I wonder, and I wonder whether this will happen. I mean, and so this is the question that I have around AI, is whether knowing that I'm experiencing this thing with somebody who made it, if that's an important piece of musical experience, or if that's sort of kind of culturally or socially determined, and eventually people just won't worry about that, because that's something that I worry about. It would change the way that the music is sort of contextualized for me. Like, I want to know that there's somebody at the other end of this that is feeling the thing that I feel. I want that, and that's part of the musical experience, that it involves others. We're doing this, we're feeling this thing, we're sort of doing this thing in a way together. And but I wonder how much of that is just my own sort of bias, and whether people 50 years from now will care about that. I'm curious. I don't have an answer for that, but I'm curious about how that'll shake out.
So you are listening to WMPG. Gumbo Shop is on hiatus this week, and Joe Arell, assistant professor at USM, is here with a number of his artist and philosophy friends talking about music and what it means to us in a variety of ways. WMPG thrives with support from listeners and from the Sock Shack, with patterns from stripes to mermaids, sizes from infant to king size. and fibers from cotton to alpaca. The Sock Shack is located at 564 Congress Street in downtown Portland and is open 7 days a week. You can get more information and order online at thesockshack.com. So, again, we are on 90.9 WMPG. And, Greg, I think you have brought to us from Northern Arizona a couple of songs that you're going to speak to. So, do you want to set those up for us? We can certainly talk about them when we come back.
Sure, I'll set up a little bit. So, just like Whitney was saying, I too teach by way of incorporating music into the class. And like all the other philosophers here, I teach existential phenomena from the existential phenomenological tradition somewhat.
What does that mean?
Yeah, good, great question. Yeah. So, in my context, what it means is an examination of how we experience the world and how, in our experience, meaning and value is generated. And Joe mentioned the philosopher Hegel, who has a big influence on me. And also another influence on me is the philosopher Martin Heidegger. He wrote a very famous essay called The Origin of the Work of Art. And he makes the claim that part of, or perhaps the most important source of generating meaning throughout human history has been art. And I try to convey how music can do this for us, how it generates meaningful context. Not that, and so that might initially appear to be sort of not mundane point, but we don't usually experience the music that we listen to as generating a world for us, but rather as something occupying it, that exists within our world. And so the way that I try to convey that to the students is by playing music that's from a strikingly different world first. And so this first thing we're going to listen to is something from what I think it's pretty safe to say is a very different kind of worldly experience for most people in modernity. It's the Dies Irae Requiem. And maybe I'll leave other things to be said for after we listen to it.
All right. Here we go. All right, Greg, did we pick the right piece for you?
Yes and no.
Yes and no. Well, philosophize on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So the Dies Irae is a prayer that is somewhere in the range, the very wide range, of 800 and 1500 years old. We don't really know. Nobody knows who authored it. It's associated with Gregorian chanting. And there's where some of the differences lie. So the way that it was used in medieval society 1,000 years ago was as a requiem for funerals. And one of the striking things about it is the meaning of the. I'm not an authority on this, by the way, but the meaning of the poem or the prayer is to draw our attention to, as we mourn the death of a person, the fact that Judgment Day is upon us, right? So in other words, they're meeting their judgment, and guess what? All of you here mourning, the judgment is going to come for you too, right? And so the way that it's presented in the medieval context is, and very importantly, purely vocally, right? So it's a vocal performance that is done inside a large stone church or cathedral, lit only by a candle, where the voices that are singing the poem, everybody participates in singing the prayer, are echoing into the darkness. And so the experience is supposed to be one where you're reminded through the activity that you're participating in that there's a mysterious beyond that is terrifying that awaits you too. So the message of the experience of giving this, of singing, chanting this piece is to not fall into preoccupation with the mourning of your loved one, but rather to think about our souls and their place before the judgment of God or something like that. And so this version, it was very engaging, and it's been used many, many times. Berlioz used the Dies Irae in his Symphony Fantastique. Liszt used it too. But this would be quite different from the way in which it would be experienced by those people. It would be haunting, and the haunting character of the experience is generated by all the participants themselves. So they're creating the experience of awesome fear and prostration through the enactment of the music.
None of this, let's go gentle into that good night.
Absolutely
all, right?
Not. Yeah, no, the Dies Irae is day of wrath. Right. That's what it means. Yeah. And yet, not in the version that we just heard, which actually conveys the wrath quite well,
yeah.
but in the way that it was done in medieval society was actually, it was very somber and very haunting, but quiet. Mm. And so, we might want to talk about this a little bit before moving on, but that part of the music being sung and not performed through instruments is going to be relevant to the strange transition I want to make to the next piece.
Hmm. Well, we can strangely transition, or you can set us up.
Sure, yeah. So, another thing to say is that in medieval society, about 1,000 years ago, there was a great deal of suspicion toward instrumental music for a lot of the reasons that Whitney brought up in her discussion, namely the embodied character of it, the carnal character of it, the erotic possibilities awakened by being moved by music. And so the sort of authorities of the church held that stuff under such profound suspicion that the kind of music that was popularly composed was sung rather than played instrumentally, and what was sung was scriptural and prayer and so on. The next thing that we're going to listen to is a piece by the Stooges, And the theme of that music is how the kind of music that's being performed by Iggy Pop and the rest of the band is going to transform you and turn you into a loose and erotic being, basically. So in other words, the very thing that was held under suspicion in the sort of somberness of that medieval era is the thing being celebrated in the music of you know, early punk rock, I guess you would say.
Well, let's have a listen to what the early church was so afraid of.
Look out. I went down, baby, you can tell. I took a rap at a pretty music. Now I'm moving to you straight from hell. Stick it deep inside. Stick it deep inside, 'cause I'm loose. Always I feel bad to be dancing, baby. I feel bad, I'm a shaking leaf. I feel bad to be dancing, baby. It's love, yeah, I do believe. I'm sticking deep inside. I'm sticking deep inside, 'cause I'm loose. Stick it deep inside, and I'll stick